Well, thank you so much. This is a joint meeting between ourselves and the Select Committee from SOP. And indeed, I really would like to thank you for coming. And indeed, you effort the same time, and I can see you all freshened up. But please thank for that. And I'm looking forward to a very meaningful engagement between ourselves. So we will be chairing quarterly, myself, and the Honorable Chairperson of the Select Committee from the SCOP. And we're looking forward to a very cooperative quarter. Good morning once more. Honorable members, and I'd like to also greet the delegation from the Financial and Fiscal Commission. And I'd like to also greet the staff members. Without them, we would not be sitting here this morning. I wish to welcome you all to this very, very important meeting, where we will be receiving a briefing from the Financial and Fiscal Commission. As we all know, the FFC is a very important institution in our fiscal governance system and a valuable partner to the work of the Standing and Select Committees on Appropriation. Today is, Select Commission is in terms of Section 214, Subsection 1 of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa, 1996, and Section 4, Subsection 4, of the Money Bills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act of 2009. And that speaks directly to the mandate of the two committees on appropriation as envisioned in Section 4 of the Money Bills Act. Honorable members, you are of course aware that intergovernmental fiscal transfers are a dominant feature in South Africa, and the bulk of government revenue is raised at national level and then allocated to provinces and municipalities through the equitable share and other grants. In terms of our briefing today, I wish to highlight a few critical points. As you are all aware, a central legacy of apartheid is the existence of dams to rural settlements with limited economic opportunities in the rural areas, especially the former homeland or homeland areas, which have particularly high rates of unemployment. Land ownership patterns, settlement patterns, and home ownership policies made it difficult for the group from the previously disadvantaged, particularly Africans, to accumulate assets, amass wealth, and become entrepreneurs. In particular, the homeland system banished millions of Africans to the poorest parts of the country, characterized by water scarcity and poor quality soil, which makes small-scale farming unviable. Small African middle class was largely comprised of professionals, strong about nurses, teachers, police, not business people or farmers. Now, in the diagnostic overview released in 2011, the National Planning Commission posed the following observations which, with regard to South Africa's special challenges. Firstly, the poorest live either in former homelands or in cities far from the jobs where they're working. Secondly, there is a failure to coordinate delivery of human settlement infrastructure between provinces, municipalities, and national government. And thirdly, it's stated that we can either move people to where the jobs are or move the jobs to where the people are. That is what is reflected in the diagnostic overview released in 2011. The National Development Plan thereafter, with Vision 2030, made a number of proposals to address these challenges. The NDP indicated that we may need to consider creating more jobs through agricultural development based on effective land reform and the growth of irrigated agriculture and land production. We will need to provide basic services, basic services that enable people to develop capabilities to take advantage of the opportunities around the country, enabling them to contribute to their communities through remittances and skills transfer. We will need to develop industries such as agro-processing, tourism, fisheries, and small enterprises where potential exists. In addition, the National Development Plan recognizes that women make up a large percentage of the poor, particularly in rural areas. Therefore, emphasis is to be placed in ensuring that public employment is expanded to provide work for the unemployed, with a specific focus on the youth and the women. Now, the transformation of the economy should involve the active participation and empowerment of women. As I conclude, the medium-term strategic framework outlines a number of targets for accelerating rural development, and these include an increase in the percentage of productive land owned by previously disadvantaged individuals from 7.5% in 2018 to 20%, reducing the percentage of households who are vulnerable to hunger from 11.4% in 2018 to less than 9.5%, reducing the percentage of the population living below the lower bound poverty line, and reduce the rural unemployment from the current 49% to less than 40%. We hope to engage robustly on this submission and find solutions that will enable us to meet our NDP targets and deliberate on concrete proposals for improving the efficiency of our intergovernmental fiscal relations in stimulating rural development through prioritizing public investment and intervention. With these few words, I would like to thank you and welcome you to this meeting. And please feel free, and indeed I'm looking forward to constructive and meaningful engagement. We will then move on to item number 2 and request the Secretariat to give us a from the NCOP. Are there any apologies?
Good morning, President, and honorable members, guests, and support staff. We haven't received any apologies, however, I'm not sure if Ms. Lopez did it because she was in the meeting.
Well, these are the apologies. We take note of the apologies. We then move on to item number 10. Which is briefing by Financial and Fiscal Commission on the submission for the 2017-18 Division of Revenue. Honorable members, now the work begins. We'll then hand over to Fiscal and Financial and Fiscal Commission to give us a briefing.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Kulunga. Let me start by apologizing on behalf of the commissioners. They were all unable to attend the meeting that attended in the Then, with your permission, let me introduce the delegation from FSC. On my left is Dr. Hamed Musa, Khalid Zawoud, Raja Pisat, Wapin Zaha, and so that's the delegation from the FFP. Take the first part, then my colleagues are going to follow through.
Okay.
Here
is
the
hand on my right, honorable member, Shortest Toilet, honorable member, Dr. Peek.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman. I just want to put on record that we are not here by the absence of the commissioner. This is a very serious commission. And we would like the country to come. And we will hear them today but it must be repeated. Thank you.
Right, so speak.
Yeah, that's my point as well. I'm pleased to be informed that this is not an important thinking as indicated by the agenda. The data that they got, the commission have gone to an important meeting. So I think that this is not important data.
Okay. How many questions are supposed to be?
We send a list to the secretary to the committee, and Professor Nicholas Tesler, can I go through the list?
Yes,
Professor Nicholas Tesler, Professor Daniel Bakke, Dr. Swami Mutua, Mr. Chris Kuma, Mr. Ken Fisher, Mr. Sipolubisi, and Professor Kihimwe Mayende. But the other one is attended the meeting in Pretoria.
Well, not even a single one of them would come here to present to us.
Thank you, Chair. I get the impression that this committee is not being taken seriously. That's the first thing. And I think surely, you know, we are required to apologize when we come in, and we are required to apologize silently in writing, which we do. And I cannot see why this is not actually being done in the first place. The other thing is, Chair, that you know, when the committee decides that they want to come and present to us, surely they need to take into consideration what we are looking for. We make a legitimate request in terms of that when they come here, that we want the entire team to come here. But now we get them coming here and we find that we get excuses like they've got other meetings. It means to us now that they've made a choice. And the choice is that this meeting is not as important as the others, so they'd rather go to that meeting. Surely I think we might have appreciated if some of them were here, at least, you know, part of that delegation, and that would have been some credit to the particular sitting that we are having. Thank you, Chair.
Chairperson, I think it would have been the correct procedure that prior to today's meeting that the two co-chairpersons of this meeting have been informed in written format that the leadership will be present. I think that it's just correct procedure to follow. That we don't hear it now. This is important information we have to deal with, which affects everyone outside in the street. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I share the same sentiments as my colleague, and I find it odd that every time, and Honorable Shekimon mentioned it, that it seems that committee are not taken serious. And it's true, we get these apologies now week in and week out from people that need to come and account for us. This meeting is important, and it was set for a long time. Ahead. So for it's strange if a person comes and say, no, you can't attend this committee because they have another meeting. So it's clear to us we are not taken serious as Parliament, the body that they need to come and account to. So I last time we had this issue and we said if it happens of this nature, and I remember we had with the documents as well, late submissions of documentary presentation. I don't, it's not a case for today, but I'm talking about all and everything of people taking the appropriation committee serious. We ought to say to them, you know what, then the meeting won't take place, because that's the decision that we took prior in as the committee, because people need to know our words, they need to know our position, and they need to know what is and to whom they account to. And it can't be that a commission just decides he wants to go and attend some other
and there's nothing that you want to do to me. There needs to be proper consequences for this behavior. Proper consequences. We can't continue with our work like this. We can't be taken for granted every time like this. And it's frustrating. It's totally frustrating. Thank you, Chair.
And this recommendation is what we have seen. May a hero in the advisory being committed as to the last in which we have lost in our hundred with regard to and attended what things were in that was not let ahead. It is having let ahead in my capacity. But being called present by minister for a letter, who probably would have known that the efforts he was teaching us on very important simply undermined not just his commission, but the budget and process of the parliament. It's a pretty other thing. And what members are saying does not suggest that the president, the tender president, is being undermined. We are not saying that they are incapable of doing what they are supposed to do. But the important thing is that the committee is one with clear leadership to address that is the survival of the committee. So, Chair, I want to have my voice and express my deepest discussion at the absence of the committee. But I must also acknowledge that in many instances, the clear leadership has always been challenged. Not the one for the rare occasion that we have. And therefore, Chair, I would like to persuade the meeting to continue, notwithstanding the content that we are doing. But I must emphasize what members are saying. This observation of members must be carried through not only to the leadership, but also to the ministers who have called these leadership to and in company with you when they were coming to be here.
Thank you very much.
Honorable Roberta, that is the chief, which has spoke now. I will then allow my co-chair also an intervention.
Honourable co-chair, I think the views of members of the committee are very instructive that we should communicate, convey strongly to the commissioners as well as ensure that as the process unfolds, the committee may, when it is necessary, may convene the commissioners to better deal with some of the communities or other areas, even issues of policy that impact on other departments. So I think we should take note of that and the suggestion that is made final that we allow the technical team that is here to have table the recommendations and very important issues mentioned. This is part of the budget process and continue to help to and what has been determined by members of the committee, whoever who has appeared before the committee will do so in the presence of all the commissioners as well to relate to this subject. So I think, Co-Chair, I'm comfortable with the issue that members have raised and the proposal at the end that may allow the table of this report. We take note, if possible, on the 3rd of June in Parliament, Shadow Committee, and now we are in the formal process of engaging with this recommendation. So we agree, members. We will strongly communicate the views that you have expressed to the Chair CEO of the FMP and also to ensure, to alert them that as we move forward with this process, we may call whoever responsible that we may want to appear for the committee. So I think we can proceed as a question.
Well, thank you so much for all the views that have been put before us. Just to summarize them, the members have emphasized the importance of this meeting. I'm sure the message is carried. Very, very important meeting. Unknowingly that the commissioners were not here, I also emphasized it in my opening remarks. And indeed, what has come up strongly also was violation of the procedure, where we were not formally informed in writing about the absence of the commissioner. At this level, this is leadership. We expect leaders to know what to do. We don't expect the leaders to be reminded what is expected of them. So we're talking, we're addressing the leadership. So we appreciate in future if we could uphold those good values, leadership values. Of course, the meeting had expressed the need to raise our concerns to the minister and the chairperson of the commission. And that will be done in writing by this committee. And our letters will co-sign that. I think procedurally we can do it, you know, to show that indeed we both sitting here and both of us are really concerned about this. And we are saying this is unacceptable. And we'll appreciate any improvement moving going forward. Indeed, the committee must be taken seriously, and from now onward, I want this to be registered. We will not proceed with our cities without the commission from now onward to show that we take our work here and we want it to be taken seriously. Remember, we're building this nation, we must all make sure that we do what is expected of us. Thank you very much. Shall we then allow you, sir? You said you are? Mm-hmm. Okay. Dr. Mugwe, to brief the joint Kumba.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for your understanding. Let me say that we try to formally communicate with the secretary. I think beforehand there were some telephone calls to the secretary to the committee to explain that the commissioner would not be able to attend. So there was some formal communication to that. And also this is the first time in the life of the commission for the commissioner not to be present in this. We regard this as our important stakeholders and we regard this meeting as very, very important. So we really apologize for that one.
Sorry, do you really want to speak now, honorable member?
No,
because
you're
now proceeding with the debate.
No, I don't think you have any
apologies. We'll do it outside for the same matter.
Right, I think the move is carried. Over to you, doctor.
Thank you. On the submission, I think the chair has really located our submission. In terms of making submission, in terms of section 2 and 4 of the Constitution, and also section 9 of the IGFR Act, as well as the Money Based Amendment of the Legislative Matters Act, section 4,
four of that one. And let me say the theme of this year's strategy is an intergovernmental fiscal relations system and rural development in South Africa. The focus is on rural development. It is part of a series. You will remember last year we looked at infrastructure development. This year is the focus is on rural development. Next year the focus is on urban development. So the series one to look at how we can sharpen IGFR instruments to develop rural areas. And as the chair located quite well, it is located within the NDP, National Development Plan. We are trying also to sharpen the instruments, especially in the implementation of the NDP. So the aim of this submission is simply to provide a comprehensive review of the intergovernmental fiscal relations instruments and their form for more effective rural development. The following year we shall be focusing on urban development. And the conceptual issue of this particular submission is that we are in a situation of low economic growth, which is a threat to the prioritization of rural development. That risk that rural development can be utterly marginalized in when there is low economic growth, and the social resources are not adequate. The submission is divided into four parts. It's divided into four parts. The first part is on the macro, micro, and fiscal context of rural development, where the two chapters are going to speak to us. Then the second part is on national government and rural development, three chapters of that. And on provincial development, provincial governments and how they can be effective in rural development. Then that we look at rural municipalities and rural development, how rural municipalities can actually be assisted or supported to enhance rural development and what instruments can be used in that particular area to improve rural development. So, my colleagues are going to take us through the recommendation of this particular emphasis on the recommendation of this particular submission. Dr. Anetam.
Thank you. Good morning, members of the committees, the committee. Thank you very much for this opportunity. As Nkululina pointed out, the outline of the submission, I'll deal with respect to chapters contained in our submission for the 2017-18 Division of Revenue. Broadly speaking, South Africa's story since 1994 can be viewed as one of a rural decline, urban growth, and a long-term decline in the economic prospects of rural regions. And within the space, government itself has committed since 1994, whether you're going from the macroeconomic policy from here now to the NDP, to articulating a program that's being speak to raise the profile of rural economies, whether you have within as recently as 2009 with the introduction of a standalone ministry dedicated to the issues of rural development and land reform and enhancing the opportunities of economic growth within rural areas. So that's broadly what it is. While we see that critical intervention by national government, provincial government, as well as local government in addressing the rural decline in the economic growth process, we noted that this growing interest has not translated into implementation of wide-ranging policies that are meant to address the failings that have been recognized within the state. And there's very little research dedicated to addressing those key features. Hence the theme of commission in Zambia. And in terms of the first two chapters, the biggest thing that came out of there was the fact that there needs to be a comprehensive definition in South Africa's context of what rural development and rural growth is. So when you look at the first two chapters of the submission, you will note three key observations. The first is that we make a clear distinction between what constitutes rural development and rural growth. One is looking at enhancing the whole level of economic activity within the rural areas. And in the context of growth, where you seek to enhance participation of rural population in areas of sustainable economic activity. The second observation is also that when you look at the context, in the modern day context, is that rural economies are not just agriculture. Rural economies are beyond agriculture in present time. When you look at since 1994, the agricultural sector itself has declined from making a contribution of over 10-12% of GDP to hovering around 5-7% of GDP. And the number of people who actually participate in the agricultural sector has declined quite substantially, making agriculture, especially in rural areas, to be one in which you have farmers taking up a living, not a commercial base, but simply on a low scale base. And the need to scale that up has formed part of government's major strategies in rural areas. And also the third observation is that there's a strong interdependence between the rural and urban economies, which doesn't seem to be well articulated within most of the policies that are geared towards the rural economy. We make a point within the submission of the fact that this interdependence is both demographic and it's also both and also economic. The massive relocation of people from rural to urban areas are impacted in how urban centers and semi-urban areas have to deal with migration, but not forgetting on the economic side, the fact that the rural economy contributes close to 20-25% of raw materials that are used within urban centers. And therefore, this strong interdependence creates an avenue which can be used to enhance the growth prospects of rural areas. So based on that, and based on the fact that presently in South Africa, we didn't have a working definition of what constitutes a rural area. What we have done, based on the economics of rural areas, based on history, based on administration, using a hybrid of these, we have defined how rural places should be. We have a slide there where we have the definition at the provincial level of what constitutes a rural area. And as you can see on the slide there, we have a ranking for which provinces are rural based on the share of certain municipalities in their area and based on the composite average that they have. So based on that ranking, you have Limpopo, KwaZulu-Natal, and the Eastern Cape as the most rural provinces in South Africa. The submission gives a technical in-depth detail about how we reach this working definition. As I said earlier, rural development is more than agriculture. A lot of policies geared towards developing rural economy is agrocentric. However, we have found that interventions need to be broader based because of the fact that the chairperson pointed out earlier. The need to enhance rural economies goes to issues that you pointed out, agroprocessing for instance. The need to employ people on a higher scale rather than living out in subsistence agriculture comes to the fore. So in this submission, we make the recommendation that a multisectoral approach needs to be incorporated into this rural development initiative that moves away. While agriculture remains the center of economic activity within rural areas, enhancing the forward and backward linkages of other important sectors provides a need to enhance a multisectoral approach in attaining the objectives of government's rural development program. So in terms of our recommendation, which we have on the slide, essentially the first one we make is that there needs to be a comprehensive definition of what constitutes a rural area and a rural development program in South Africa. And this definition needs to be applied across all the three tiers of government. So when national, provincial, and local governments speak about rural development, they are clear, well-articulated, and are speaking from the same page about how that definition has come across, taking into account the geography, the demographics, and the range of economic activities that are performed within what you have defined as a rural area. The idea is to deal with disparities between and within regions that are classified as rural areas in addressing and harnessing their potential for economic growth, and the need for sector departments that are tasked with this function to have a comprehensive agenda in which they're able to relate to one another and are able to comprehensively have a framework that speaks to each of their programs that complement each other and that contradict each other. In the third chapter of the submission, we looked at the role of intergovernmental transfers in addressing rural poverty. Because as the chair has been pointed out, the framework for intergovernmental fiscal relations seeks to address a whole gamut of issues, in which includes your rural development. So you have a national department that's dedicated to rural development and land reform. You have provincial departments of agriculture and land reform that also have initiatives targeted at their own specific rural areas. And you also have municipalities that are classified as rural, also having a range of programs that they need to carry out. So in terms of that, have an intergovernmental system that speaks to the issue of rural development. So in this year, in terms of the third chapter, we are making the recommendation that a one-size-fits-all approach would not apply because of the fact that different economies exist within our rural spaces, and we need to understand how this can be properly addressed in carrying out the goals of moving populations away from poverty into sustainable income. So in terms of our recommendations, we have made three major ones. The first one is that a framework for the implementation, evaluation, and monitoring of key agricultural grants needs to be set in place, especially those that are targeted at subsistence farmers. Most of the population within rural areas participate in subsistence agriculture. Right. So your land reform programs are targeting people and scaling up their participation in the economy. Now we need to move away from simply having people carrying out subsistence agriculture for their own primary needs to feed themselves. So actually seeing how they can use that, as the charity alluded to, so things like the agro-processing industry, the linkages between them, the linkages to manufacturing, for instance, in urban centers that surround certain rural areas, the linkages with commercial agricultural activity, for instance, and that, how that can be harnessed quite properly in scaling up their culture. The second recommendation we make is that when you look at agricultural activity across municipalities, you have category A, B1, B2, B3, B4. The bulk of agricultural activities are carried out within your mainly rural municipalities, the ones that are within your category B3 and your B4. And more than 20 to 30% of the agricultural activity are within these areas. Hence, we are recommending that you do not need a blanket approach when you are targeting these municipalities in terms of enhancing the agricultural related activities that can lead to further growth of these municipalities. We are recommending that where need be, agricultural based grants that are made to enhance the functioning and economic prospects of municipalities need to be targeted at those where agriculture is actually the mainstay of the economy, not a mere one-size-fits-all approach. Beyond the existing grant framework, we are requesting that activities carried out by a range of government departments within rural development space need to be better coordinated, and there needs to be further communication about how the roles are meant to be. We need to see complementary roles in terms of rural development objectives. So when you, for instance, look at the budget book for the Department of Agricultural and Fishing and Forestry, you also look at the budget book for the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform. You also look at initiatives within private sector. Most of the budget boards and the initiatives speak to issues of rural development, whether it's supporting certain groups within the population, such as women within rural areas, if it's supporting subsistence agricultural, if it's supporting agro-processing activities. We need to have a framework in which these different programs are complementing one another and not contradicting one another, and speak to the role carried out by municipalities who are defined, which are defined as rural, rather than has their own programs. And also rural municipalities need to incorporate within their IDPs the planning for grant funding, for the planning for the funding of infrastructure that are geared towards raising effective investments that create linkages for the mainstay of a particular economic activity within that particular jurisdiction. Thank you.
The next chapter that we'll be looking at will be the National Land Reform Program and Rural Development. Now, land reform is one of the main government declarations aimed at stimulating rural development in the rural space. And the departure point for this particular study is the essentially the debate about whether the land reform program has in fact achieved quality outcomes that it intended to achieve. So there are two main key objectives for this particular study. So one is to assess the impact of land reform on key policy outcomes, and the second one is to assess how the implementation of the land reform program can actually be improved. Now, when we look at some of the key findings of the study, what we did was we conducted the survey in three provincial or three provinces that were considered to be rural, and where large amounts of land reform programs were located. So from the findings of the survey, what we found in terms of our results was that food security declined in all of the provinces. With the exception of some programs, projects with a small proportion of operational projects that were being implemented. The other key finding of the survey was that there were large production losses took place after the conversion of the land to of the farm to land reform. And this is largely because many of the farms went out of operation. And then finally, as a result of that, there also significant job losses, with cases in job losses declined by 94%. So what we observed from our findings is that despite the significant amount of resources that were implemented and that we pumped into land reform, from the results in terms of the fact that we surveyed, we're not getting value for money for our land reform program. So moving on to the recommendations, we've made four key recommendations, and I'll just touch on some of the most important recommendations. The first recommendation speaks to the need to consolidate the comprehensive agriculture support program and the recapitalization program into one funding program under the auspices of the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries. The reason we are making this recommendation is that both funding instruments are actually funding the same activities in the same rural place. And therefore they are essentially duplicating the same activities. So to avoid the issues around double dumping and also inefficiencies as a result of having two separate programs, we are suggesting that we combine these under one funding program to be able to achieve much more efficiently. The second aspect of that recommendation speaks to the need to implement to introduce affordable loan funding to land reform beneficiaries. And currently that's one of the biggest funding gaps that we've observed in the study. Many of the land reform beneficiaries unfortunately do not qualify because they are considered to be risky in terms of issuing the loans from the bank. And so if government is going to expand the reach of land reform, which is only focusing on a very small section of beneficiaries, they don't find it deeply part of the equation in terms of the funding framework. Then I just want to touch on the third recommendation, which speaks about implementation. And what we are recommending there is that where there are implementation gaps that is identified, this should come from reprioritized baseline funding within the land reform program. So we know that we're quite sensitive to the fact that there is very little money available in the subscript and consider them in full program. Much more can be done with resources available. But some of the implementation gaps that we've identified are things like, for example, a lack of planning. We know that there's very little planning that is being done between land reform and municipalities where land reform programs are taking place, as well as other key functions such as human settlements. And this is largely because this function is not being funded, which is causing a huge amount of fragmentation within the land reform program. The other aspect that we've identified is a major gap, is the lack of training on technical skills as well as business skills. So while land reform beneficiaries may have farming skills, if they can operate farms commercially and viably, they need to also be equipped with the necessary technical skills as well as business skills to operate for those farms sustainably. And then lastly, when it comes to the allocation of land reform farms, we find different provinces have different sets of criteria for how they allocate. And we are going for a standardized way in which land reform farms are allocated across various provinces. Moving on to the next chapter. So this chapter looks at the role of public entities in rural development. And over the EDS period, 813 billion rand is being allocated to infrastructure. And 77% of those resources are going to three main sectors: electricity, energy, and water and sanitation. State-owned companies essentially are responsible for 45% of that infrastructure investment. So this chapter essentially looks at how state-owned companies and development finance institutions can be an extra driven for national development. Now, public entities or state-owned companies essentially have two goals, and sometimes they don't always complement each other. So one goal is that state-owned companies are tasked with addressing some of the socio-economic backlogs that are currently faced with in the country, but at the same time they also have the function of being commercially viable, which is the important secret code to be able to play that role that required in terms of the national financial plan. Now, over the past 5 years, the financial viability of state-owned companies have declined. So looking at some of the key findings, firstly, we assessed four state-owned companies. We looked at ISCOM, Telkom, Transnet, and Telstra. And we also looked at four GFIs as well. And when we assessed these case studies, we noted that they don't have a specific rural development focus in terms of their core mandate. And while they don't have a specific focus, it's not also clear whether they are supposed to also have a clear land reform or other rural development focus in terms of the activities. Now, moving on to the recommendations that we made, I'll just touch on the most important one. The first recommendation speaks to the need for the national department responsible for these DFIs to identify one specific DFI that will be regarded as the champion for coordinating rural development financing in the rural sector. Currently you have the Land Bank, IDC, and National Economic Development Fund, all the financing programs for the rural, for the agriculture and the rural space. Yet, none of these speak to each other in terms of these specific programs. So this recommendation is saying that much more can be done with these three programs, or the whole of the DFI that have a specific rural development focus, actually come together and form some coordinated approach in terms of financing rural development. Then recommendation 2 and recommendation 4 complement each other. So what this essentially says is that the Department of Telecommunication, Education and Public Services should work together with with Telcom in order to roll out mobile markets in rural space. That's the one aspect. The second aspect is to also
focus or extend the services of the South African Postal Office to not just focus on the landlines, but also to reposition the South African Postal Service so that it's a one-stop shop in rural areas. So what we're implying by that is that the traditional view of the South African Postal Service is that it rolls out landlines and deals with postal services. But there are also other physical services that the South African Postal Service can also include in the rural space, such as for financial services, for example. So we need to try and reconceptualize the way that the South African Postal Service conducts its functions, especially in the rural space. And the finding that we found was that most of the rural inhabitants use mobile phones rather than landlines. And therefore we are calling for the expansion of mobile phones, access to mobile phones within the rural space. Moving on to the next chapter, which looks at fiscal transfer and all the revenue funding for visual rural development. So this moves to the next level, which is your provincial sphere, and look at how does the provincial sphere fund rural development in terms of the fiscal mechanisms which they have at the disposal. We know that there are a number of rural mandates that the provinces are involved in, education, housing, roads, and agriculture, to mention a few. And therefore, these rural mandates impose unique services and funding it on rural provinces. So this, what this study does is basically assesses the fiscal instruments, whether the fiscal instruments are actually responsible to the funding of rural development. So here you look at both your fiscal transfer in terms of your PEF and your conditional grant, as well as your own revenue account. So some of the findings that came out of the study. Now with respect to own revenue, what we found was that rural provinces optimize revenue collection. Own revenue is mostly because of the lack of economic base, but also at the same time, limited revenue raising potential. So in most cases, rural provinces are able to perhaps raise between 2 to 4% on the revenue. So they are unable to achieve their rural development mandate without any significant fiscal transfer. Now, with respect to the provincial equitable share, what we found was that when we looked at the PEs from 2000 to 2013, there was no responsiveness to rurality. In other words, the PEs focused largely on funding provinces based on the number of individuals in a particular province. And that is specifically look at the rurality in terms of allocating resources. So the next thing we went to was to say, okay, fine, if that is how the PEs allocate resources, do individual provinces allocate resources in terms of in a way that actually can be considered to be rural bias? And if we take agriculture as a proxy for ruralness, we know that on average provinces spend about 4% on rural development, which is really a very small share of the total amount of people. Moving on to conditional grants, though, we see the picture of the different. Over 50% of infrastructure conditional grants are actually allocated to three most rural provinces. So we see here that government has taken the approach of funding rural backlogs, processing rural backlogs, largely through the conditional grant framework. However, there are key questions that are outstanding. First, are these conditional grants going towards addressing the infrastructure backlogs in the rural areas? And to what extent are these conditional grants actually achieving the outcomes that these infrastructure grants actually have identified? Moving on to some of the limitations from this particular study, from the chapter. And here I'll just focus on the key ones. The first recommendation is saying that the provincial offices of the premier, in consultation with provincial departments that are responsible for rural mandates, such as education, health, you know, agriculture. Should I simplify the rural development deeds within the province and reinstate penalties of recalculation which the VAT allocation book system? So we know that at the provincial level, your provincial executive and the legislature is responsible for allocating how the fees is going to be split up according to the various codes. And what you are saying is that province should take responsibility and identify targets against which the fees is going to be allocated and vision in terms of spending on rural development. And then the last recommendation is we are basically saying that departments of planning, monitoring and evaluation should conduct a comprehensive review on the expenditure outcomes associated with infrastructure conditional grants targeted at rural provinces to ascertain the extent to which infrastructure backlog has been reduced and the efficiency of spend. So in this recommendation, we are basically calling for that gap that's currently lacking in terms of assessing the efficacy of these provincial costs and rural development to be assessed to ascertain what the outcomes are so that we know whether it's extent to keep it or not. And finally, the last chapter for the section looks at fiscal instruments funding public employment programs. And here what this chapter basically looks at is to what extent are fiscal instruments that are funding public employment programs creating jobs within the rural space. I will just touch on some of the key results that flow from this particular chapter. The first finding that we that arose in this chapter study was if you look at job creation programs throughout government in the different years and sectors, you note that although there are various programs that are aimed at creating jobs, for example, your job funds, the incentive programs for teachers and others, very few of them have actually a rural focus. And many of them are, and most of them are actually not targeted at addressing the large unemployment programs. Now, when we compare the two main steps, your EBWP and your community work program, we found that spatially, most of the jobs created by your EBWP are actually located within your metropolitan areas. Whereas, with respect to your CWP, most of the jobs are located within your small town and rural areas. So essentially, these two several programs complement each other in terms of the spatial location. Also, what we found is one of the attractions of FEMS is that unemployed people, while they are able to be employed on a temporary basis for 2 days a week or for a certain number of months, they are able to also gain specific skills on the job, training on the job. And what we found was that 51% of the beneficiaries of EPWT, 70% of that around transition into full-time employment. So we see that there is a certain amount of people that transition into full-time employment, although the amount may not be as high as we would like it to be. Moving on to the recommendations from the study, just want to speak on a few of them. The first recommendation is essentially saying that of all the different state programs that you find, government should focus its resources on the CWP as well as your social and income sectors of EWP as an explicit strategy for rural development. Now, the reason why the agency made this recommendation is because we found in the study that still over 70% of the resources is going towards your infrastructure sector of your EWP. Yet, to create one full-time job within the infrastructure sector is significantly more than creating the same job within your CWP, social as well as your NPO sector. And so the reason for that is because your infrastructure sector is not really labor intensive. Whereas these three sectors are labor intensive as well as the fact that many of the activities that they conduct they themselves to be implemented easily in the room set. And then the third limitation is such that the Department of Public Works and National Treasury must ensure that the framework EBWP in the Division of Revenue Act should include explicit conditions that appropriate training of the service should be included, especially in skills that promote self-employment opportunities, which should be facilitated. So what this recommendation is essentially saying is that, well, some people are receiving training on EBWP, a big chunk of these beneficiaries are not receiving training, which limits the potential of EBWP in creating or rather transitioning these beneficiaries into full-time employment. But because of the rigidity within the labor market, which often concentrates on training these individuals within and equipping them with skills, so they are able to be self-employed as well. Which will encourage, of course, much more sustainability of this initiative. But now I know my colleague will take us to the response to the chapter.
Good morning, dear members of the committee and other colleagues. I'll take you through the last four chapters of the commission and focus specifically on issues related to rural municipalities. So the first set of recommendations in the section are based on research we conducted into the financing of rural municipalities. We looked at this issue in the context of a considerable number of rural municipalities being very weak revenue bases and being highly grant dependent. There are also a considerable number of municipalities that are either already stratified as dysfunctional or unviable, and a number of them are also at high risk of being classified as such. What also importantly prompted the research was the recent COPSA proposal on amalgamating municipalities as an avenue for making them more viable and self-reliant. So one of our key research questions was whether amalgamations would serve to curb grant dependency. There are a number of key findings, but the main one is that amalgamations will not automatically result in financially viable municipalities. And the main fact worsens the situation in the large municipality. And this is because amalgamations cannot solve all and every issue that gives rise to dysfunctionality or unviableness of a municipality. For example, issues around financial mismanagement cannot be solved necessarily through an amalgamation. So in a number of instances, what we need to do is determine the root cause of that dysfunctionality and solve specifically for that. Moving on to the recommendations, there are five of them. Two of them relate to how government should approach the issue of amalgamation. If we move to what we recommend is that the Department of Cooperative Governance amends the Municipal Demarcation Act to ensure that the full financial impact of demarcation on the municipality is assessed before any amalgamations actually take place. Also that the department seeks to correct for dysfunctionality through relevant legislative policy or capacity building measures and that amalgamations be sort of last resort. There should also be close monitoring of where amalgamation mergers have been successful and the actual costs of these mergers should be quantified. If we move on, the next piece of research and the coming recommendations looks at effectiveness of existing distribution of powers and functions between the district and local municipalities. We know there are numerous challenges that hamper rural municipalities in fulfilling their constitutional mandate, and the often ambiguous allocation of powers and functions between your districts and local municipalities compound the situation. So the first step in our process was to look at how efficient your local relative to your district municipalities are in terms of delivering services. And what we found is that in rural areas, local municipalities can produce about 60% more output or service delivery within the existing envelope of resources. So basically that local municipalities have a lot of room for improvement when it comes to efficiency or efficiently using the existing resources. District municipalities were found to be relatively more efficient, and this is not specifically in your rural areas. They were found to be more visible and more involved in delivering services directly to your households. So there are two recommendations. And if we look at that second bullet point, we recommend that COPS further differentiate the system of local government with a view to introducing a single-tier local government system in urban areas and to strengthen a two-tier local government system in rural areas. Further, that COPS reduce the accountability mechanisms of district municipalities in order to make them more accountable to citizens, and that as a matter of urgency, COPS provides clarity on the functions and powers of district municipalities. As noted there, in light of the white paper on local government, the powers and functions of district municipalities should encompass district-wide planning, coordination of strategic development, and intergovernmental relations policy issues. So we recommend that COPS clarify the role and function of districts as a matter of urgency. The next set of recommendations relates to the issue of form emissions and the burden places on the rural municipalities. It's important to note that legal fixation with respect to the role of government, specifically your municipalities in providing at least temporary or emergency accommodation for evictees. And what we aim to do in this piece of research was firstly to quantify the extent of the burden placed on municipalities as a result of these evictions, and also to investigate whether there are any fiscal instruments to alleviate the burden placed on your rural municipality. The key finding there, if you look at the last bullet point, is that the cost indications of farm emissions range from 0.1% to 1% of a municipality's LES allocation. And just to provide you an example of the amount of money we're talking about, 1% of Emakazeni's LES over a 5-year period amounted to 875,000 rand, whereas in Breede Valley Municipality, 4.1 million was spent over a 5-year period on things like emergency housing, legal services, and informal settlement control. What we also want is that the availability of fiscal instruments to alleviate this burden placed on your rural municipalities are limited. Municipalities rely on using their own revenue. But we noted that existing municipal disaster grants is allowed to cater for emergency related emergencies. So what we recommend is that the same approach of accessing that portion of the disaster grant should be applicable to farm eviction incidences as well. Secondly, we recommend that governments strengthen the coordination and implementation of existing programs targeted at district farm workers and dwellers, and this should include including your farm EVTs among the beneficiaries for housing in the rural towns. The final set of recommendations for our annual commission relates to our review of the fiscal instruments and governance of sanitation in rural areas. The overarching aim of the research was to understand the nature of the constraints that hamper government progress in terms of addressing sanitation backlogs in rural areas. Now, as we know, due to the limited revenue raising capacity of rural municipalities, they are heavily reliant on intergovernmental transfers to fund sanitation. And here, the instruments include the local government equitable share allocation, the municipal infrastructure grant, and the rural household infrastructure grant, or RIG. And the rural household infrastructure grant is actually a free funding source when it comes to sanitation. What our analysis shows is that none of these intergovernmental funding instruments adequately supplement the funding of sanitation in rural areas. And with RIG, we noticed significant underspending. And that arises due to two key reasons. Firstly, the late submission of business plans, or where business plans are submitted, they are of poor quality and not detailed enough in terms of the division of revenue requirements. We also found that where rural municipalities are able to install the required sanitation infrastructure, most of them do not include sanitation plans as part of the integrated development plan, and many of them do not have maintenance plans in place. So the result is that very little is allocated in respect of the upkeep of this infrastructure. So there are 5 recommendations that emanate from the structure, but just to summarize, we recommend that rural municipalities include sanitation in their IDPs, and that farmers should play an oversight role here in ensuring compliance with this recommendation. We also recommend that rural municipalities develop complete sanitation infrastructure plans that will spell out where maintenance will take place, how it will be, how it will be funded, as well as the technology that will be used to improve sanitation in your rural areas.
Well, thank you so much for the insightful presentation. I will now hand over to the co-chair, Honorable Mahai, to take the meeting from here to the end.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair Sosa and Honorable Members. The FLC team has tabled or elaborated further on the submission table in Parliament around June, the 1st of June to be specific. So various chapters were elaborated, and I want to say beforehand, as it was indicated earlier, that the committee will continue the discussion during the LGBTS and the budget process. This is a very important part that is linked to the budget process. And also, we need to indicate that based on the committee recommendations, we may call SALGA if you want SALGA to make specific elaborations based on the submission. We may call the Department of Land and Rural Development and have joint discussion so that we enhance further discussions because we're interested in policy areas and the extent in which financing of the department fulfills objectives of growth in production in the agriculture area and rural development, because we would normally say that it's in and around agriculture, but not immediate home, as the presentation has elaborated. So that will be for us as members of the committee to determine who we want to appear before the committee. We have joint discussion around very important issues that has been made. So I want to invite you, honorable members, to have a discussion. I recognize you, honorable Shal. Yes.
Yeah, listen, I'm sorry to hear you left off with that remark, very important one. When we take this step further, for other engagements, let us invite the Chancellor of Finance and the provincial legislators to also be part of that engagement with the SSC, because this is a provinces as well, and bring them on board. And as a fact, after this meeting, I'm sending this to my legislator in Kimberley and on the paper to all my councillors and my constituency and my ESC provincial office. On page 19, slide 19, regarding to monitoring, evaluation, etc. That slide just actually sets the oversight program for this committee. I think we must do some work differently. When we call these different departments to one meeting, those stakeholders sitting here, because sometimes it takes months before they talk to each other, receiving an email or a letter, then you must let you receive my correspondence. What is happening? That those stakeholders are in the same meeting when we engage on the specifics that's mentioned on slide 19. It's going to help oversight role, and then we go outside of Parliament to go and do our work outside. Are all the transfers to rural local government adequate? Slide 22. Where is she? Yeah. Regarding the spending of those allocation funds, and that's our job as appropriations to monitor that. And the Treasury can give us that information that we can answer slide 22. So, and then last it said, slide 16, improve the outcomes and work infrastructure in the rural areas. Ish. That constituency comes back with 5,000 up in the mountain. Kamishpat Mountain, the highest peak in the northern state. And we've got serious challenges in Kamatis, Northern Fear, and the local land. Coming on for several years, engaging with Telkom for several years, and we can't move. The former mayor of Thomas Bab met with the chair of communications last week, Thursday, in Cape Town. And this is a serious matter, Chair, because we get a heart attack, you wait for pain. Bad luck. We're going to bury you. There's no communication, the clinic down, down and out and in from the school. That's a reality. Even the Department of Education is battling with communication. So this is a very serious point. And thank you for the interest to highlight this. Our rural areas. You go to KGN up and down the mountains, down the valleys, into the river. There are schools down there, next to the river, in those valleys. We were there, in COP. We're going back to double check what happened. So this is a very important matter. The communication in our rural areas, one, affects education, affects health, affects church, affects other stability. Thank you,
Chair. Thank you very much, Honorable Charles. I think the question did acknowledge President for Treasury when the Managing Treasury responded to a perceived recommendation during the admission of revenue stage. So it's a part of an important process. And I think I would just like you first to give members a chance, FFC. You have made a very important point here around state-owned companies and their lack of, or their core mandate, not defined the issue of rural development. That's a very profound, that's a very important one. So it's part of an issue, I think, issue that we need to pursue. How does the own companies reorientate themselves towards addressing major areas of development in the country? It's quite a very important issue, because the issue of mobilization of resources in a massive case to ensure that growth and development is good. Another special area that we talked about is important. But I want to check with you. Do you think that beyond aid intervention, is there a way to finance a massive case or mobilization of resources through other means where have these private partnerships or with limited hope to this intervention of the state. I just want to hear from you, FFC. I think there is also the issue of conditional grants, but whether or not this conditional grant is it a vehicle for rural development, say, some binding. It's quite very interesting. Remember, I'm Honorable Mam, Honorable Matofa, Honorable Law, Honorable Ndala, members from the NDP are still recovering from a long time from Mexico. So thank you very much. So from the oversight, the report on Twin Peak legislation. So can I talk my members here? In that order, I'll come back to the second stage.
Thank you, Chair. Co-Chair, allow me to thank FFC for their annual presentation here this morning. There still seems to be an indication from my view that people are still moving from the rural areas to the urban areas. There's a great impact on the urban areas. And that is, and our city does not enough development. Now, in my view, I feel that there must be more emphasis and incentive to allow industries and businesses to move into the rural development. And I must agree that too much of emphasis is yesterday. I think when we talk about rural development, I think the first thing that comes to your mind is agriculture. And really, it should not be like that. We've been saying this repeatedly with regard to trying and paying more attention to the manufacturing industry and things like that. But I don't see it being converted on the ground and something happening about it. We talk, but there's nothing really happening. So for me, I'm thinking if you want to have success in those rural areas and not allow people to really come to the urban areas, then you have to make every rural town into an urban town. I think that's what should be, the ultimate aim, so that we can have people live there. But remember also, these people that move from there, there's a lot of negative impact together with that when you move them. The this social impact of families living far away from each other. Then you have extended marriage, and then there's no control by birth, because you never see your kids. So, you know, for me, it's a vicious cycle at the end of the day, that rural communities like to have actually changed. I was here, I think, you know, and I think it was in Canada, actually, I don't know if you are aware of the way there's a two-tier system in some of the areas, national and district level. And just these do play a very, very important role. In my view, I know lots of people are not going to like it. I sometimes find that the provinces are failing us because they have a lot of responsibility in terms of ensuring that the local government and sector four, and they tend not to do that. Remember, before the construction of oversight, before it even comes to us. So how many different departments and structures have failed before it even comes? It should not even be coming to us. But it comes because people, they are not just generally performing. So I really think that would happen. You know, I've noticed even with the state, or if you take Telkom for example, the easy way of for Telkom is that they borrow the services of what MTN and things like that, but they have not rolled out the network into the area yet. So you use the services and then they feel that they can do it. But I was thinking that we come up with the state, especially like the post office. Here your motor vehicle licenses should be at the post office. You use the post office service for your postal issues. But every other government thing that you go to, they should be done as a one-stop shop that you actually make it viable. Because right now, the post office are in a decline. Very bad. The people have lost confidence. And I think in the last report that we have had, a great percentage of people have almost shifted away from the post office because of non-performance and delay and whatever it is. But maybe the one-stop shop is getting various and amalgamating a whole lot of services into those portals might again try and actually bring it in line with some kind of success. My concern also is the VIP toilets. It seems like there's a lot of emphasis now on VIP toilets rather than going and providing people with the sanitation. For me, I think that is you know, the other thing that I've noticed, especially in the rural area, is how overnight. Everything in the rural area is substandard. It's like accepted fact that it does not have to be in line with what we find in the urban area. If you go to the schools, you'll find the quality of education is all kind of low. If you go to the clinic, you'll find it exactly the same thing. If you look at sports development, it's like a non-existent thing as far as I'm concerned. But there again, I think there needs to be a coordinate. So if we want to improve the rural development and improve the life of those people, I think we need to do it a coordinate and a holistic way. All the different challenges that they face and what we can bring together, which is basically the health and things like that, bring them all together. So that we could try and change the lives of the rural, which I think we could definitely, much as a lot has been done, but I don't really believe it. I just want to kind of just talk about the demarcation and the success of it, because, you know, what I learned here and what I think is frightening, because if the demarcation is not taking place for to benefit that community and make them viable, financially viable, then what really is it? What is the purpose of it? Is there some things you can maybe perhaps give us some extra, give us some information on those that in recently been demarcated, what were the positive successes that have come out of it, and what are the challenges, how has it really changed the life of the people, how does it make the municipalities more viable, and these recommendations that you are making to us here, have you ever sent made any of the recommendations to government in terms of looking at these aspects as to how you believe we could do things a little bit differently to be able to achieve more? Thank you.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. Thanks to the presentation. And also apologize to come later than the other portfolio committee. Chair, I think this is a very informative and useful information that we have received this morning. I want to check because I think the research that they have done really talks to challenges that is being faced by most people in the rural areas, the issue of the job creation. And they correctly indicated that it is not biased. You know, all the stages of funds, the DTI, all the incentives that is being received. It only benefits those that are in the cities, but not the people in the rural areas. And also, I want to say, because we have got a lot of infrastructure backlog in rural areas, and it gives a challenge in the sense that it can't attract investment to rural areas, hence seeing most of the people moving to the cities. you can look at the statistics by, you can look at the statistics. South Africa, they are saying that in Joburg it's like 18 million people that have moved, you know. And in other areas, rural areas, they are moving in there. Can we try and look at the criteria of the equitable share, its criteria, to say that it's focused, the population is also important, but also focused on the backlog, on the areas where they are backlog, and we give them more, so that they can try to uplift the standard of those rural areas and attract more investment in the rural areas, because if there is no infrastructure in rural areas, it's difficult. Even if you can say agriculture is not the only, you know, vehicle for development or economy in the rural areas, but if there is no infrastructure in the rural areas, it's difficult really people to stay there. And also because it's indicative that also the jobs are in the city, you know. So it's something that I think we need to look at and check whether it can be one of the criteria for equitable share to focus on the backlogs, more backlogs in rural areas, so that when you have got that infrastructure development, it creates jobs in the rural areas rather than people moving in the city. The other thing, Chair, that I want to check, the recommendation is indicating that, one of the recommendations is indicating that the COPTA needs to transfer to the issue of clarifying the powers of the district. I'm not sure whether they are fair in the clarification of the functions and powers of the district vis-à-vis the local municipalities, because I thought it was clearly outlined in the white paper as well as in the legislation. Maybe if the presenter can indicate where does he or she sees the gap around the issue of the clarity on the function of the district municipality, so that when we engage, we know exactly that where the cops are need to up the pace and clarify the issue. And also, lastly, on the issue of job creation, and also to say that the infrastructure is not creating a lot of jobs around this of the EPWP. I'm just checking what prevents the department to put it in the specification that in that particular project, they must be labor intensive, rather than, you know, only using the machine and having one person coming behind the crater, you know, taking the stone, you know. And also, I think also we plot the researchers and the presentation, because it's up to the thing that has been our content to say that EPWP, one of the components that they must be training. But no one is really monitoring whether it's being done. And also, hence the recommendation to say that it must be emphasized, the issue of the training of those people, so that they can be integrated to the
formal work in the sector.
Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation, presenters. I must say, I would be very disappointed if you didn't present yesterday, because when we were going through the presentation, your recommendation spot on recommendations. I just hope that your recommendations don't just go to a drawer and it gets up. I just hope that it gets implemented, because it's spot on issues that we have seen, even on our oversight trip to the rural areas that we are doing. And so I really hope that these recommendations get to see the light of day and it gets to be implemented. Because it can't be that you have state-owned entities that can't, or that is not rural development focused, or they can't even contribute to in that regard. It can't be. So we ought to here today. I just said I have some few questions, Chair, and I think it's one or two or three pertaining to the presentation. On page 3, to me, I just want to find out if even if the presenters don't have it now, they can do their research later on, because maybe they don't have the information at hand right now. We are talking about 130 municipalities in a particular category. If you can just furnish us with that municipalities that I get in the names of those municipalities, 130 that is in that category. And then when you in your provincial grant, have you formed any research pertaining to which other what is the word? Which other factors are contributing, like your corruption, your irregular expenditure, and those things are affecting these conditional grants? Did you do research pertaining to that, and how does that affect these grants? Our municipality is just taking them, and then it goes to certain industries, individuals, and stuff. The EDW. Have you done work as to see, because in some areas and in some municipalities there are guilty of that, that you have a municipality, let's say you can't get department, you can't get the EDW job unless you show a certain membership card. So have you done also research pertaining to that and ensure that these EDW get to be permanent jobs? Because you can hire a person for 2 months, they have a 2 month salary, and then the other 3 months they don't work, or the other 11 months of the year they don't work. So we ought to develop this program, that these individuals that are in this program get skills, and they get to be in the market, because if I'm on that program, I won't be able to maybe go and open up an account, or to understand, to save my life. So have you done work in that regard to put recommendations that these jobs of the EPW must become a permanent sector? And also in the agricultural sector, I just want to also check, like, if you have done research specifically to women and their involvement in the agricultural sector, do you have a set amount of number that you can maybe finish us with of the number of women that participate in the agricultural sector currently? And then, just a word on the other chair. I'm just going through the slide quickly. And then, and then also, I think on page 16 to me, and some slide 51, one of your recommendations of the role of Banoka and the oversighting role, I think it's also where we ought to get in as an appropriations committee, to see that these recommendations that we have put in are get to implement, and then start to take this day oversight role very serious. That's why this morning we had a situation where we said we can't have this meeting as a committee is not here, because we take our oversight role very serious as members of parliament. So that must be going down, and also the sound that you send to them. We ought to take your oversight role serious. We can't have entity overseeing something and they are not taking the oversight role serious. Chair, I think for now it's only that if I have taken by the role, I'm in with the others, then I must.
Thank you very much, Honorable.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me just thank SSC for their presentation. It's a part of a series in many within the Division of Revenue. But I think what becomes clearer as the SSC does this interrogation of different aspects of the Division of Revenue is there's a recurring trend. It doesn't matter which aspect of the Division of Revenue you're looking at. That seems to be, whether it's systemic or whether it's inherited because of how we've designed our system. There seems to be generally a lot of duplication, whether you're looking at GFIs and SOCs or local and specific municipalities. So there's a lot of duplication, so you find that when you're duplicating the work that you need to do, you tend to benefit the same areas and the same generation. And that's something that always comes up. Then there was alignment of the different grant funding. And I know there was a process undertaken by National Treasury to look at all the grant funding and then look at those that are also duplications and where there's misalignment of grant funding. And first, I know probably Wendy or National Treasury, as we go and talk through the process, they'll be able to come back to us and tell us how far that process is of looking at all the conditional grants and all the different types of grants there are in different departments and whether that rearrangement of the grant funding has concluded and how successful. On your recommendations, you speak about, maybe just your comment. You speak about the SOCs and the Jefferson made the comments about the SOCs. But also DFI, there's different DFI, and you speak about align or coordinate the efforts. It's not related just to have one single DFI that looks at rural development and agrarian reform. And whatever budget allocations they are, go to that one DFI and have a dedicated, just one dedicated DFI that looks at that, as opposed to coordinating and relying on those down there. Also, we previously made the recommendation, I think both to National Treasury as well as to COPTA, on the process of funding mergers and collapsing municipalities. And the National Treasury can also, or maybe the government will have to call up, I'm not sure, get a response from the relevant departments as well as National Treasury whether that process has been concluded. The costing of mergers. And if they've been costed correctly. Also, the other recurring problem that we have is the district versus local municipalities. And I think the reason that this always comes up is because metro municipalities or bigger municipalities, by their very nature, are supposed to be self-sufficient. So for us, the concern about metropolitan municipalities or more urban municipalities is how they are using their money more prudently and efficiently. But the ability or inability of the cities and local municipalities to generate income, that burden lies with national governments in most instances because they rely on that grant funding. And I think even yourself, FSC, makes the observation that some municipalities will just almost never be self-sufficient because of many different reasons. Either they are underpopulated, demographic, geography, and that sort of thing. But whether it's a municipality that is self-sufficient in terms of generating income or relying on national funding or grant funding, either way, municipalities must be able to spend whatever money they have correctly and prudently. And I think between National Treasury and COPTA, there has to be a concluded process of how we get there. Just lastly, your recommendation on allocations being weighted. When you say that the category D3 before municipalities, instead of using a blanket approach, do you not think that while I agree that a blanket approach is not the best method, but do you not think that defining different types of grant allocation for different areas would not be more difficult to monitor and evaluate? Maybe your comment on the two types as a better approach and then something that is needed. How will you effectively monitor debt as opposed to having a more consolidated approach when we to rural development. And I think maybe you have a consolidated approach to rural development when you understand what is rural areas, what is rural development. Thank you.
May I take the two members, Rubanyani and Honorable to make their comments?
Thank you very much, Chair, and thanks to the FFC for this very useful presentation. I would like to start by saying that, you know, I like the approach that we use, this integrated approach to rural development. And something that has been mentioned over a number of years, and I would like to just add that, you know, rural areas are definitely not the same. There needs to be fighting. You find that, you know, some areas come to my mind where you find that in that area there's almost nothing, almost zero development. Where they, you know, we've got sometimes the tendency to go and build a school, but there are no roads, there are no roads, there's no water, there's this thing. But I was just mentioning a few things there. And I think I'm hoping that this particular approach will actually assist us with having this a comprehensive approach. Agriculture, as was mentioned, cannot be seen as the main thing, because as you would know, during the apostate era, maybe I can say during the good old days for the rural areas, because the rural people were able to sustain themselves. They would farm, they would have livestock, they don't have those things. They were stopped from having a livestock and things like that. And not a person also with a climate change, I suppose, things just don't grow in the country. Besides the fact that they cannot have those fees that they have. I've noticed that in some places where we used to have fruits and things like that, they don't have peaches, apples, they no longer have. And I will make an example with one, not necessarily mentioning that one of the oldest rural areas in Hillsdale End, one of the reserves that we related to the Group Areas Act, which is just minus 70 feet old. It doesn't have water. People don't have water. They use communal taps, which sometimes don't even have water. They do not have shops, the schools are far, there's nothing called scholar transport. If they have to go to an ATM, I'm not talking about a bank, they've got to get into a taxi to reach an ATM, to reach a post office, they have to travel, and they have to pay close to 100 rand for the return trip, just to reach a post office or an ATM. Now we're talking about people, maybe you send them money. Instead of them just throwing it direct, they have to travel to really get that money. So all I'm just trying to indicate is that, you know, a very targeted approach is necessary when it is with the rural area, because there isn't infrastructure. I'm always imagining this particular area if there were to be an ATM for it. I don't know where they would put it because they have no infrastructure. I don't know how to describe it, but there's just no infrastructure in the particular area. There are no jobs, so there are no opportunities for job creation. And a program like the EPWP would be very, very useful for these people, but there isn't anything whatsoever that is happening. If you know the Woodstock Dam concept, those people are going to the Woodstock Dam, but they don't have water. That big dam, which is also supplies other areas, but they don't have water. So water and sanitation is almost 90% in those areas. It's just by way of sharing that. These are some of the challenges that we have. Sometimes we expect a lot from the municipalities that they must provide. You ask yourself how. Because it may be a matter of lack of capacity, but it's also a lack of resources. Like in the same area, because I've got a particular issue because I have energy there. They started building RDP houses, they're still starting, apparently the funds ran up and they're going to continue. So it's issues like that. I have a whole lot of it here, but I think I will just end it because I really wanted to talk generally about the challenges we have in the rural area. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Member.
Honorable Member. Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to add that, you know, I think it's a good document that our colleagues from Health and also the recommendations that they make. I think that we are failing at a different stage in the process. You know, we are failing at the implementation stage. It's all about, you know, the determination of priorities, allocation of budget, stuff like that. And then again, I think also in government, we have a tendency to approach things in a silo approach. I really think that we need to go back to the so-called integrated government service delivery model. You know, and then we need to bring the services to the people. People, we will not be able to get investors investing in those areas if we don't have proper infrastructure like roads, telephones, water, etc. So I really think that, you know, we are failing at implementation phase, and I just think that it calls for a political will and obviously priority. Thank you, Jefferson.
Thank you very much, Honorable. Thank you, Chairperson. I'm going to be brief because most of what I sit down has been touched on, but just a few issues. The statement was made that the land bond program has not been decoded, and none of these is given because of the lack of support from provincial and local government. Beneficiaries don't have access to credit, and again, the one that has come up quite often is the lack of suitable infrastructure. So, and I want to support my colleague from the USA saying that we've got these issues that have been raised, and it's important that they do not stay in other words, in the draw. So it's important that we need to make sure that these issues are dealt with. The other issue is the issue, again, that's based in your presentation about the support from the FLC, like the 2000. Honourable Sekunyane touched on it, and she said that the additional need is also the provision services, and I mean, so that one of the reasons, or she gave one of the reasons. Look, if there is a solution, there must be a solution, because the knowledge that I have is that some of these ATMs might not be suitable, but some of them are people at home, so, you know, as long as that person is reliable. But I'm just saying that we need to, you know, we, government needs to come to a point which obviously the information you are giving us, but I think there also needs to be, and I think there should be incentives for the private sector as well. So it should not only be the responsibility of government, but it should be, because it's going to cost less if you have incentives. With respect to rural municipalities, there are some challenges, and again, I'm referring to the presentation with respect to limited revenue capabilities, poor audit results, maladministration, underspending on capital budget, self-delivery process, backlogs in service delivery, inability to service debt, and we wonder if nobody's touched on with regard to this one is the lack of institutional capacity as well as human resource capacity. So it's important that, you know, your towns are one of the best providers. The information we get, effectively all the information that we can use. But here in the house, or yeah, from presentation to presentation, we get it, we look at it, and we say, okay, fine, just because it's part of the budget process, it mustn't be like that. It mustn't be just because we are compliant legislation. It's information that CFSM need to use in order to improve the lives of our people. I mean, as you hear from time to time, this committee wants to make a difference, but we're not going to make a difference if we sit here and listen to presentations, and then we listen to the next presentation, and then we pass the Division of Revenue book, and then we pass the Appropriation book. It's not going to serve any purpose. So yourselves have done your work. It's up to the committee on the chairperson to do our work. So it's important, and I would like to make that plea. If I refer to just a four slides, if you allow me on the chair. Slide number four is information about the rural urban migration. From 43.4% to 38%. So should we then re-look at the amount of funds that are allocated and how the funds are allocated? And I'm making a second because does it help to put the challenges that these rural municipalities have? Does it help them to give more money? Because in one of the other slides, we talk about, and this is where on the clarification, reprioritizing what is meant by that. Does it mean that we take in money from one area to add it to rural development, or are we looking at spending it more efficiently and economically? So, so that's the top, that's the source of my question. Slide number 14. Okay, that's the one about the reprioritizing of the bodies. Slide number 16. Okay, just two more of the we have touched on this and we just talked, okay, maybe I should just talk on it a little bit more. You spoke about health and their expertise that they need to assist more and get more support. But I should more intensive not be into your other networks as well. And I'm just going to ask a question. Because obviously it's an important place. And then my last point is the issue of this EPWP. I'm one of the few that doesn't support it holistically in its entirety because of the objectives that have not been achieved. As Honorable Alo said, if we give somebody under them a day for 2 months, now the intention is good, but if you give somebody under them a day for 2 months, you can't transfer any skills, because the objective is to transfer skills. It's also labor intensive. Now, what skills are you going to transfer? Because one of them indicated in the presentation is that you want to make entrepreneurs out of them, which is a good objective, but can you achieve that in the time and the funds that are made available? Because with the underground day, before you even get open, the underground is finished. So I just wanted to make the point is that could there not be another suggestion? It helps the poor, sorry, the very poor, but it's not going to make somebody, and I'm talking your ass to work with my view. Thanks, Honorable Shaw.
Thanks, Honorable Shaw. Thanks, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm just remembering what my mother taught me. She taught me that in your life, when you encounter a problem and you want to solve, the first person to blame is yourself, not another person. Because if you blame yourself, you will find ways of solving the problem. Where the problem of poverty, of lack of rural growth, and I think the commission has done it well, very well. They have diagnosed the problem, they have advised us, and other institutions do come to advise us where the problem is. I would suggest that as members of parliament, we should own up and say, we have to do our oversight. We have to call the department and make them do what they must do. You know, the first minister of finance in the U.S., and this to say, people will not account unless you make them account. And I think we are not doing enough as parliament to make people account. They have shown us that it is weaknesses in the public work, in the land and rural development, in agriculture, water and sanitation, and the provinces, and further. As the Appropriation Committee, fortunately, we have the power to call all these people under one roof and actually give them our view, the advice that we got from our advisors, and we tell them to do as the advisor has said, and follow it up with oversight to check if they're doing it. Not after a year, after the Auditor General has given a report, too late then. You know, I remember very well in one workshop in 1998 when we were still dealing with a bill on the Public Finance Management Bill, it was a bill which was as Act No. 1 of 1999. They insisted on timely reporting, and they also insisted on quarterly reporting. And we asked President at that time, why? What
because it is not enough. I'm not impressed to just to hear over saying this department is ordered or this one is a bit. What is important is to make sure that the resources, the scarce resources of our country in this difficult fiscal period are used optimally in the benefit of promoting growth in our country. That is what we as this committee should we should look at. And I want to suggest that when we do call the people, we should do it together. We were talking about silos. I always find it very beneficial when the Senate committee and the Senate committee work together. So I would encourage that we do that. And I think we should also call some of these district municipalities in those states. Because as far as I'm concerned, I come from the Rand area. I struggle to find it where actually this is, I just hear the executive mayor. I just don't know. You know, I like to touch people, you know. The municipalities in my neighborhood, I tell them. I sometimes go to review them on their IDs. I sometimes think this is the mayor, the president, but this one, I don't know what happened. Okay, so let's maybe say over of the appropriation function and call those departments that have been mentioned by our wise men. Thank you very much. This is very informative and I can assure you we will do this. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Shofa, for the comment that the committee must make critical self-reflection with regard to the kind of oversight that one could play so that budget process remains what it is, that is a very important process of determining priorities, and that well thought of the process decision making in weighing different areas. I think that's a very good point that is made by honorable member. Can I tell us members now? I'm not extending further. And then there are honorable McLaughlin and Jawad. They are sitting next to each other, so they have shared some notes properly. So please, can you make your remarks and I'll give the co-chair here to make the... And then FFC team has potential to respond on. And we make up the process for us. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. I know it's been said already, so there's a lot of other things to say. Thank you to the FFC, they've done a good job. That's given us great recommendations, has already been mentioned. I just want to establish from you, when you did this survey and search, was there any element in your thinking that you want to reverse the trend of urbanization? You want to get people to start leaving towns and going back to rural areas. Does it enter your thinking as a sort of policy point in a search like this? Because I sort of stating the obvious, and it might be a controversial issue, but all things we complain about rural areas is what makes them rural areas. If we fully develop a rural area, it's no longer a rural area, now it's a city sort of whatever else it is. So we have to obviously maintain a balance. Rural area we need to retain as a rural area. It has to stay that way. And when it comes to the definition you mentioned of the rural area, I think too we need to be a little careful that we don't once again have a one-size-fits-all kind of situation when it comes to rural areas, because in some rural areas obviously it's arable land, it's very agricultural, it's a workable land, but then there are other large tracts of land that aren't arable. You can't have agriculture, you can do nothing with it basically, but it's still a rural area. That was one of the downsides I guess when we divided the whole country up into municipalities. Every resident of every municipality is entitled to the same services as every other resident. But you make it very difficult for a municipality to be able to comply with that when it's a place where you can't get access to, there are no roads, it's a shitty, mountainous, rocky, or things like that. And I think sometimes we miss the boat a bit, but we need to surely identify things specifically for the area we're talking about. And whatever that particular area has its core and place and those, whatever it is, that it has to be there or not be there, as the case may be. I guess the same sort of thing, you say that the role of agriculture, this is in, it's right, 7. We all know that agriculture is interfering with the rural provinces is declining. It's a concern because obviously as the cities and the urban areas are bigger, their need for food is more, and yet our ability to produce it is shrinking. And while once again, obviously we need to address that issue specifically from the food security point of view. But the need in the rural area might be less, if that's not why it's shrinking to an extent, because the perception in the rural area is different than the perception in the city area. I just wondered what was meant was an expression I've not seen before, implicitly silent, which is mentioned in slide 9. I don't know how one is implicitly silent, but either silent or not. But an expression I haven't heard before, and I wondered what your comment would be on. Slide 20, you say there, or state there, only 17% of those who go to the EPLDP program ultimately end up with sustainable jobs. Did you do a similar percentage survey on the CWP people? And what percentage of them do not make it to sustainable jobs? That would be an interesting fact just to see within that scope of what's stated there. And then slide 26 and 27. You made the comment here about municipalities could increase their performance level by 60%. Can you unpack that for us a little bit? How would they be able to do that? Is it just a question of the day and they're not doing their jobs? Are they not selling the services offered correctly? Are they not collecting the amounts due to them the way they should be doing? What if you base that they could improve their performance by 60%? And then my last point is, you make the point twice, in effect, in slide 26 and 27, but district municipalities tend to operate better and provide rural services, other basic services, than rural municipalities. Now, my experience has been the other way around. The district municipality doesn't provide any services. They're sort of a drop gap. So I'm very much in favor of the two-tier system, but I always thought it would be more effective having a local municipality reporting directly without this little layer of the district municipality in it. But your suggestion would seem to be the other way around, which I found very interesting because, as I say, my experience, the rural municipality is usually the one that provides services, not the district. The district might assist with some service provision. Certainly it's not the district that provides the services. Just a question I had as to why you would say that. Maybe your experience with these specific municipalities is different to what my experience is. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Member. Honourable
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. That was slide 7. You made a resolution that rural development has evolved from simply being agriculture based to other forms of economic activity. I want to understand that. And in fact, it is true, but I'm saying that government has not really taken advantage of this evolution in the rural areas and advance and increase economic activity there. And if that has happened, what are the urgent steps that need to be taken to take advantage of this evolution and make it into to the on slide 39, where you refer to the municipal disaster grants to be used for this year, have you considered that there could be unintended consequences? For example, increase the mission because government is providing relief for that. Possible undermining of land tenure for farm dwellers, etc. and so on. And how could those unintended consequences be dealt with? Three, I want to confirm what the I was saying about the observation you made about the state owned enterprise. But the challenge of state owned enterprise is that we see the intervention in economic activity insofar as areas where there is potential for economic activity. And for them, the potential is in the metals and some towns that are economically active. They haven't really, and as the government has not, outlined what their role should be in rural development and land reform. And I think that's an area that we need to focus on. I agree with Makai. But linked to that as well is the whole question of IEZs and special economic zones, which were created to begin to respond to the issue of economic development. In the rural area, are we making inroads, especially with the special economic zones? I know they are relatively new, but how much are we doing there in dealing with that subject? I raise this issue because the issues that are coming up about the different types of municipalities, their inability to collect revenue and therefore expand their resources is partly arising from lack of economic activity, lack of employment in rural areas, so that those that are can then take responsibility and pay for services that municipalities are made. So something needs to be done at that level. Because remember, we have a limited cake in the national income. But of course, the issue is as well, how do we reorganize that limited cake in the national system to respond to issues related to rural development. Part of the theme of your presentation was intergovernmental fiscal issues. What are the disconnected related to this lack of coordinated fiscal information? Partly lack of clear policy as far as rural development is concerned. It is also partly lack of policy implementation where policy exists, implementation and coordination. Is there a need for a particular structural intervention, structure created to look at this coordination, implementation, coordination, and creation of policy where it does not exist, where is the need to do it? Is there a need for that? And lastly, Chairperson, when you look at rural areas and economic development, the second basic thing that we expect municipalities to provide in terms of water, sanitation, and so on. But what are other elements that would encourage local manufacturing? You've recognized agro-food processing, manufacturing, etc. So, besides these services that must be provided for a local level, what else needs to be done to encourage economic activity in the specific local manufacturing? natural processing, etc. So, for instance, if you look at, for instance, the sport plantation in the Brazil, cut and transported elsewhere for finisher to blend in the pressure, sometimes outside the country. What conditions can we create, for instance, for local manufacturing of finisher? I'm making an example of it. There are many others that you can look at. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Sawal. Coach, can you make your comments and speak over for this work?
Honorable Chair,
Honorable
Minister, I have already indicated that this was a very informative presentation. I then, having listened to this presentation, I would like to say, in terms of cash language, 21 years down the line, there is no intervention in the life of a rural child. 21 years down the line. Now, this should then be saying the desperation that we go into that place and turn the situation around. Those people have been waiting patiently for all of us to change some of them or intervene and change their life in the world. Now, the other aggravating factor in the rural life is the farm addiction. Now, I know that there is a proposal that we give the disaster, I think it's disaster nation grant, to also address the issues of those farm dealers who are evicted from the farm. It's not an easy one. It means you have to address this, but it's big. This problem is big. It doesn't people are quiet about it. It means there would have to be adequate funding for this intervention. Because what it means is the farm owner will wake up and take his people with all their properties and just dump them to the street. Now, the temporary measures, maybe we can then say, maybe put that you recommend, but of course it's not the solution. Well, those need to be taken, given a place where they can stay in their children. Not that emergency grant or intervention, just a tent. And that's it. No water, no toilet. And now you're saying this grant must then address this one. Everybody is really serious. I think we have all of us to think on how best we can intervene and assist these people who also have, who also are supposed to enjoy equal rights and be treated with dignity in terms of the constitutional privilege. There is a problem, a serious problem. The worst part of it is these people on the farm, but the farm will not even agree that houses, because he cannot provide housing. I was a social worker a long time ago, around the era of 1981-82, when I did home circumstances investigations. I found that all the people were staying in chicken rats. Now, you will see, if you mean meaningful intervention, indeed, we have to start now to take rural development seriously, and it has got to be prioritized. I have worked with this thing. I'm talking from an experience. All right? So I think we must think, and not only think, ensure that indeed money does get channeled for this intervention as well. Now that agency fund is not enough. Can only provide a tent, and that's it. Now, where
present government, because then we cannot be the NDP. In my meeting, I said I was shocked when I heard an HOD say, if NDP does not get fighting. And I said to myself, they need to think again. If there is a plan, it means in your plan, you will then, or in your budget allocation, you will then have to allocate, as I'm saying, the other day, allocate your funds, linking your funds with a plan. Now, for an energy to say there is no budget, you must do these things, but there is no budget. I think our children will have to ask us, and be serious, and think deep in their thinking, and take correct decisions to assist this government. Because there is a plan, and there is a budget. And the DSMA says you've got to link your budget with your plan. So, actual implementation of the NDP with an aligned budget indeed will assist us, because it's also, the NDP talks about wealth in the government, it's one of the priority areas. So, I think that it should have to assist us. Indeed, we need to turn this situation around. Cannot be fair. I feel that we're more with the Commission on the multi-sectoral policy approach. It sounds correct. But in your thinking, when you want this policy to be developed, by which department? Because if you don't put it, it will end up being a very good idea. Now, you need to, in your recommendations, recommend which department must now come up with this policy and by when. Because we are saying we're dealing with a desperate situation whereby visiting here, enjoying a better life, some people have not enjoyed this better life, 21 years. So, as far as I'm concerned, government should immediately give instructions to a certain department to come up with this policy, and that policy should not take long. So some policy development takes long. I don't know whether it's deliberate or it's because of what is involved. But that policy development, if I understood the commission correctly, has to be done with immediate effect. There is no time frame for that. There's no time frame, it would remain there as a good idea. Now, on the task team to develop a definition for rural development. Now, I know government has now adopted a policy of developing task teams. As far as CZL is putting it, that task team will be a budget, and some task teams have taken more than a year to start to do their work. So what are we saying? What else do you want to do? It's an issue. Because the task team will be saying members will not have behavior rules, they're still selecting the forest members to sit in the task team, and we're not interested. I think they have already institutions of higher learning who have research units and are waiting for us to use them. I think the other alternative can be we approach a university, a particular university, and ask that university to work on this thing for us. And I promise it's going to be cost effective. It will not be costly. It should not be costly exercise. They are there already waiting for us to challenge them so that they can then assist us in finding solutions. Because they're a university, they're not interested in finding solutions to this country. So that's the thing, if you can reconsider this, we are an experience. Take on and take money, and money we don't have. Alright, on the agricultural productivity, you are proposing an establishment of a framework for the implementation, evaluation, and monitoring of key agricultural products. And even here, I think there is desperation to turn the situation around. You are correct to say, after the land reform program introduction, there was loss of production and loss of employment. Now this country is still a problem of unemployment. I agree with you on establishing a framework,
you know, to promote this agricultural product. But when program is within here for 21 years now, and it's only now that we're talking about this. And I can assure you, whoever wants to be, every black person will not give you the censorship of the fact that I mean, now 21 years, and only now this thinking comes to play. It is good thinking, it can't be a little bit late, but how soon do we want this? Because if we don't put time for it, I still want to believe. I don't know, so, but you can say within, you know, to recommend it, within 6 months or within 3 months, take into consideration the desperation we are confronted with. As long as there's no, I know, means you just give it as an idea, it will remain in the books, it's not what we're interested in. One, the actual implementation, because we have promised to give the people of this country a better life than a quality life. It's not what we promised. What the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa says. It is a constitutional imperative. Yes, but in the main in which you have been helpful is that you can do your presentation should have been fair off on the message put before.
Thank you, Chair. Honorable members were very comfortable to be all of them had sufficient time to raise their comments and areas that we need to go further in dealing with very important subjects before us. And I think I'll just sum up when I conclude in terms of the way forward, what the meeting says that we want to let the committee. So Doctor, can you respond to issues where you want to take your process in dealing with the issues you indicate? So you're welcome. Just question that we are not going to go beyond one.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be very brief and quite a lot of comments, very useful comments, and let me say some of the comments they make our research agenda because we cannot provide all the answers here. We have not had them, we'll go back and do further work where necessary. Then in fact let me start with the issue of our recommendations. I think we will be taking our recommendations to all relevant actual SALGA. We are going to address them, these recommendations. There are some which pertain to them. National Treasury on behalf of government has to report to these recommendations, putting together all recommendations from government as well as provincial governments. We'll go to provinces as well to present these recommendations. The difficult one is on putting timelines. We recommend to legislators on the things. Then perhaps the legislator when they address some of these issues with government departments or some of these things. In our case we usually make recommendations, but here and there we can put some that might happen here, but we are planning on giving deadlines. Then on other issues I'll go on to some of the technical issues that my colleagues will also add later. Then there was a question on transfers to rural municipalities adequate. It's a very difficult question. We tried to interlocate that one. And what we found that first we need to deal with inefficiency. Sometimes it's not a question of money which is not adequate. There are issues of inefficiency which we need to deal with. Then also we need to look at funding, and we may find that sanitation is funded from this particular source and that particular source. You look at one source, you may think that sanitation is underfunded, but if you look at all the streams of funding going into sanitation, you may find that there is a lot of funding going into that. So the implications of that is that we need to continuously review all these funding streams, see whether one is underfunded or underfunded. And also, when necessary, we need to consolidate some of these funds. It's a process which has already begun, I know, working with National Treasury on infrastructure grants. Some of them are being consolidated as we discuss the process which is ongoing. Then on, there was an issue on conditional grants. Are they a vehicle for rural development? There could be a useful vehicle for rural development. But we see that in a number of these grants which are focused on rural development, there is a lot of misalignment, underspending, or complete inefficiency in those particular grants. So we need to iron that
to make that a decent mechanism for rural development. And we saw also problems to say there is little revenue, but most of them they are present and offline. So then they need extra resources which are just pushing out. But in terms of using this kind of, there are a lot of inefficiencies. There was also the issue of migration. I think it's a very, very serious issue. If you think of it, in 1911, 82% of the population was in rural areas. 2020, only about 30% in rural areas. That is a very, very, there's a lot of migration. So what is important is that is also coming here is that we need to develop rural areas so that migration is less. Because it's imposing a lot of pressures in different areas. The pressures we see, and even when we look at our next year submission, we shall see these particular pressures in different areas as a result of migration. So there is a need for rural areas to be developed, and the issue of incentive is to provide good incentives to rural areas for these companies to go and locate or invest in rural areas. The issue of incentive is very, very important. It's something we can use in this grant, as this grant is not there. Incentive for that. Many industries and companies locate in rural areas. When there was an issue of logistics, I think it's a very important issue. What we are saying about this thing is that if you look at all the rural and urban you find that urban or districts in urban areas, they are no longer performing substantially the mandated to perform. You look at laws, they say districts must do A, B, C, D. But those urban areas or districts in urban areas are not performing those functions. And this is because different MECs have been giving this power to local municipalities. And as a result, the strong municipalities in urban areas are performing functions. That's why we're saying that they need to review the role of districts in urban areas, but stress the most ones in rural areas because they are performing at a very good function in rural areas. So that's the decision that in urban areas they need to rethink the role of districts, review their role, but in rural areas, stress them, that's why we're keeping calling for ministers to come in and spend them, build capacity in urban areas. So, but on problems, we need to be special on that, and it's something we need to think of. Then this is to that is the question of demarcation. That demarcation, we saw it for the first time in the history of the country, that demarcation was the proposal of demarcation also as a financial viable. But we are saying that there are some municipalities which will never be viable. And the division of revenue is meant to catapult municipalities which are not financial viable. You can't put a municipality which has a weak economic base and another one with a weak economic base and all these municipalities will be viable. We were saying 0+0+0 is not about to say that it will remain 0. So that's the point you are saying here. There are some, we must accept that there are some which will be dependent on transfer, they will never be financial viable. But there are those which will be financial viable. Then the other classification of this, which I think our point here was really about in light of this district which are not performing their function, can we really look at the classification of this particular district. On women, I think we can provide some statistics as well as the statistics on the 130 we can provide the last one. Then, I explained the two-tier system of corruption in privacy. And the other point I want to really, the issue of 50%. That municipalities can increase their output by 50%. We did a model where we calculated the efficiency of the municipalities and we saw that some municipalities, given their current resources, they have now, they can increase their output by 50%.
which implies that the final number of plant free candidates which are not second in document, they are due to carry the process of the lottery edition before asking for more money. So the question of the edition is, and which is not to link the product, is not to anything which talks to the issue of corruption, which is within whatever the very important point. Then the issue of disaster grant. Yes, disaster grant will help some SSD. In the sense that they'll encourage more farmers to evict more people for municipality getting some of this. So there's a risk there which we also noted that there must be to qualify for this particular grant, there must be some careful scrutiny of municipalities which can buy for this particular grant, so that it doesn't involve the interest of many people being evicted and also municipalities applying for as a revenue measure that within a short possible time there must be some working of this. Then I'll briefly hand over to my colleagues to clarify or certain points briefly.
Thank you very much for your insightful questions. We'll try as much as possible to address them. Let me start by saying that one of the questions, I see the trend emerging from the question that the rural development is quite important. How can we achieve this? What mechanisms can we use within the present framework to achieve this? And how can we go about this to make sure that these achievements are sustainable in the long term? So how is always the biggest question, and to what extent can government intervene? There are two clear opposing views if we look at what happens outside of South Africa in other countries with a similar setup. We can go to Chinese road, where China has decided that by 2020 it will move 250 million people from rural areas to an urban setting. And by 2030, close to 900 million people will become urbanized citizens. That's a constructed government effort to shift the landscape of the Chinese situation. It has resources to do that. On the other hand, you can allow places to develop organically. As Dr. Rubin has alluded to earlier, in 1911, 82% of the African population resided in rural areas. Growth of certain areas, whether it's by fortune or by trade, certain areas emerged from being rural to become urbanized or semi-urban, while some have remained rural. As Honorable Ross pointed out, some areas will remain rural over a long period of time. That's welcome and acceptable. But the question there is, how can we ensure that those areas can create sustainable sources of income and revenues for citizens that reside in there? We're not looking to reverse the trend. What we're saying is that there must be an ability for people to earn a living within the area they reside in, whether it's urban or whether it's rural. So the crux of this submission is that within rural settlements, create the opportunity for people to have access to building of their own life and opportunity thereof. South Africa's rural areas account for 80% of the land mass in this country. If all were equal, if everything were equal, manufacturing industry should be able to take advantage of cheap land in rural settings to locate themselves in that area, providing a source of employment for people who are located in that rural area, and happens within a lot of countries. But the question there is that South Africa faces a situation where the manufacturing output is declining because of the global economic trend. What normally happens is that another sector can definitely take over for the manufacturing is labor, which is the services sector. But the services sector requires a safe space and a high level of human capital, which the rural areas also have. So you have those twin dynamics that is constraining sort of the group of the rural area. Now, I mean, we'll tell you, I have a question about why are we recommending that agriculture, we don't have the one-size-fits-all to agriculture. And our key recommendation was that you need to uphold the principle of the equitable distribution of resources that's within the constitution. It does not mean that you give everybody the same. If you have the money, you give everybody equal. No. It means that based on your particular set of circumstances, you treat people fairly, taking into account their own particular set of circumstances. And we already have that within the provincial equitable share and the local government equitable share formula. When it takes into account the peculiar circumstances of particular region and try to use a formula to address those. The recommendation we made was that in terms of agricultural-based grants meant to provide incentives to stimulate rural economies, take into account, number one, which participating within agriculture? What is the labor intensity? Who is affected? What is the equality in terms of land distribution within a particular area? Using that, they are able to configure which areas are the most needful in terms of how you're going to allocate your resources. And we stipulate there that take into account the participation of people in agriculture, the output of agriculture in particular areas, we list a number of principles that you can follow in order to reach the particular target that you're looking for in distribution of your agricultural base rather than a one-size-fits approach. I know, but according to you, you've asked the question with me. Yeah, it is not a straightforward answer in terms of how can you incentivize people to move to the rural area. As I pointed out, the preliminary thing is that you must have a big set of incentives to attract companies to invest, to actually come within your area to manufacture, for instance. And as I pointed out, these do not seem to exist. As honorable member mentioned, the fact that certain infrastructure are substandard is already a precursor to companies not wanting to come to that area and actually invest in it. So in terms of what the chairperson has pointed out, this integrated and coordinated approach of ensuring the rural areas have the basic set of infrastructure, it doesn't need to be the same level as an urban area or sector, but it needs to be adequate enough to one, address the service delivery needs of people within that area, and two, foster the attractiveness of that particular area to bring in investments and that would enhance their own local economy. So these are the issues we highlight about within the submission.
I'll just respond quickly to two or three of the issues that I need to say. The first one was, Honorable Speaker was saying whether the resources are being relocated from other sectors or whether it's within the actual sector. In that recommendation, we are saying that must be resources within the agricultural company, as we feel that there are resources there that's not being used efficiently. There was also an issue about including a backlog indicator in the PEA formula. Now, since 2000, so since inception of the PEA, the formula has evolved over a number of years and it's been certain components that have been included and taken out. In 2000, the backlog components were also included in the PEA formula, specifically to address a rural backlog in the rural province. And in 2005, a poverty component was included. Now, both components were 3% in total. What happened in 2005 was that the backlog component was removed from the PEA, and government decided to fund backlogs through conditional grants. And the idea was that the poverty component would be an indicator for rural men. But the challenge there was that the indicator for poverty does not lead itself to reality. So you still have a situation where the PEA has this special issue that needs to be addressed in some kind of review. So in this chapter, we don't recommend the review of the PEA in this financial year, but we say that in future, when it is a review of the PEA, specific credit issues taken on board. I mean, there were quite a few questions relating to the EPWP, and essentially, if one looks at the question, the overarching issue is how do you make EPWP sustainable for beneficiaries in terms of the hydro support. Now, if you look at the EPWP conception, the vast majority of resources were allocated to the infrastructure sector, over 70%. And the problem with the infrastructure sector was that beneficiaries participated on the program at 3 months, 6 months down the line before they were sitting without the documents again. So it was short term in nature. And secondly, despite the condition of the need to be labor intensive, many of them were not labor intensive. So what happened was a lot of the resources that were part of the EPWP did not go to poor households, simply because contractors were not used to the idea of solving infrastructure through the agreement. So in our implementation, one, we seek to try to rectify the situation. So those sectors that we've identified at the EPWP in your social sector and EPO sector are labor intensive in nature, but also at the same time, they provide some kind of minimum employment guarantee. So in terms of the CWP, beneficiaries participate on the program for a minimum of 2 days a week, but there's no termination of that. So they can continue for as long as they want until they develop the skills to transition into something that's more longer than beneficiaries. Yeah, so I'll just on that point, on the end of the question.
The question on the interest fees, just a little bit of background and work rather than research. The starting point was what came out of the presidential review committee on interest fees, which was settled in 2013. So similar to the findings, there were definitely benefits in greater use of your PPP. Specifically, we see the strong need to expand on the use of your private sector industry collaboration when it comes to delivering your key economic and social infrastructure. But as the chapter notes, the starting point is to first be very clear on what the contribution of the SOC should be in furthering the developmental agenda, specifically in your rural areas. There was also a question around the issue of around sanitation and the use of VIP. That is to note that what we covered in our research was that these practices actually moved from the use of VIPs to a technology known as EcoStack. Most of this technology is more environmentally friendly. It's also way more cost effective. So that's why we recommend that municipalities need to investigate the use of this smarter technology. Thank you.
Are you done, Lucy?
Yes, it's still well done.
Okay, thank you very much for the FFP team, Dr. Newman and the team for sharing this valuable presentation with the joint committee. And then this is the proposed way forward by the committee. I think my co-chair will say that I will go in for the treasury to the comments. No question, simply that treasury is here and we are going to create a platform for treasury to discuss their recommendation of the FFC at the right time. So treasury will come and see those areas. Now that's a useful relationship, FFC mandated by the constitution to look into the distribution of the fiscal resources, whether or not they are equitably shared, and so forth, and national treasury. Now to say what we have and analysis how it can be distributed. So that's a very important and healthy tension that always arises when making such determination. The first point I think we think that in view of the fact that the FFC submission has been formally tabled and referred to the committee, we must find a way of reaching there to the whole consideration of this committee submission. But that will follow the following process.
we need to broaden our participation in dealing with the FFP recommendations, ensure that as members of yourself, we must avoid to be more routine-like in dealing with this process, just to satisfy the legal requirements, but ensure that we create a platform for discussion on this important policy area and taking our proposals that are proposed, so that we are able to create a platform where we hear our contending views regarding this very important subject. And the third area is that our secretariat, together with the budget office, will just consolidate our program to ensure that relevant departments, like the Department of Land and Rural Development, is invited before the committees, stakeholder enterprises, and as well as SAWAGA, so that we are able to really discuss in depth recommendations that are made. So that we don't, even in on agriculture, it could be very important on the Department of Land and Development, that also to hear areas of investment, to what extent that the department implements some policy areas. Part of what we said in our country is that whenever it falls in a massive way to growth and development and creating employment, the larger scale without addressing ourselves to industrial policy, aspect of industrial policy that the department is implementing. What are those areas? Where are they located? So that development is not a social neutral process. It's where it's located, there are problems that we're solving. So we require that department to be able to share with us some of the areas that are raised here. And SAWAGA, of course, for obvious reasons, and we agree with you, there are many policies that will never develop because of the lack of revenue basis and number of things, but how do we respond to that? Some of them were highlighted by the in the state of the nation, to say repeatedly different policies that require dedicated attention and extraordinary support to continue to provide basic services. How do we move forward? So I think this is the proposed areas that we deal with, and we'll ask the secretariat to ensure that either we create this meeting prior to the MTVPS platform by the minister, so that we have a broad discussion that members have expressed, where we are able to adequately deal with this issue. And I think it's a valuable point that you make that NCOP and A use different but complementary roles to ensure that really we ensure adequate discussion at the team of this intergovernmental, so that ensure that relevant stakeholders across years of government are part of this meeting to deal with this subject. Thanks very much. You agree, members? Thanks. The meeting is adjourned.